looks to me that it's a spurious argument, because the death of one man under unclear circumstances cannot be construed as an attack on a nation for which this nation has to invade the other nation. In other words, the reaction and the application of that point doesn't seem to me that it would hold any legal, international legal ground.
Now, the clause reads that it's any aggressive action taken against the United States.
Exactly. This time there's no aggressive action against any country. There was the death of one individual, which cannot be construed as an aggressive action against a nation. So it looks to me that it's pulled totally out of context.
Now, the interesting thing about the entire invasion, or whatever term you want to call it, is the fact that the U.S. Defense Secretary, Richard Cheney, has said that this has been in the works for about 10 months. Would that not contradict, then, the U.S. argument of the self-defense?
Exactly. In other words, the invasion has been prepared all along. If they have prepared it all along, means this argument is just a cover argument, and it was not a true argument behind. Why should then the United States have prepared for 2 years to this moment? And in fact, in the last 5 months, clearly the White House came out encouraging and supporting with the logistics and money anybody who would topple the foreign government.
How does the Panama Canal fit into all of this?
The United States has already appointed their Panamanian administrator for the canal about a couple of weeks ago, and unilaterally. And at that time, the Panamanian National Assembly, together with all the opposition parties, they objected this unilateral appointment and on the basis that it was violating the Carta Torrijos Treaty, that it had to be mutually appointed. And Panama had named their man for this position for January 1st, and the United States vetoed it on December 5th. And subsequent to that, Panama has chosen a man by the name of Fernando Manfredo to be the administrator for the canal. So in fact, I assume that now that they are taking militarily over that country, they are going to put that man, regardless.
Speaking of the U.S. Appointing a position, the president who was democratically elected back in May, Guillermo Andara, has been appointed as the president of Panama. Noriega called a press conference last Friday and declared another person the president of Panama. In 3 months from now, or 6 months from now, who will be running Panama? Will it be Guillermo Andara, in your opinion?
Certainly not. I guess Panama has been always run by the military, and the military was run by the Americans. Not completely, but in fact, any high-ranking officer in the Panama Armed Forces has been trained by the Americans. And so is true all over Latin America. So, in fact, the whole militarism since the 1960s has been built up following the national security doctrine of the United States, in which there was a priority for the American foreign policy in Latin America to build up strong military. So the whole thing about democracy, I have to point out to you that Mr. Andara, Guillermo Andara, was never elected democratically. In other words, the polls said he was going to be elected democratically. But let's remember that, legally speaking, the polls are not the election. The election is the counting of votes, and the counting of votes never finished, never took place, because in the midst of the counting of votes, there was violence, and there was stealing of boxes with votes and other things. So the Electoral Court of Panama declared null and void that election. Therefore, that election never we never knew the results of that election. So legally speaking, that election was not allowed to come to fruition. I'm not disagreeing whether Mr. Andara was winning or not. I think the perception is that he was winning, but in fact, the vote counting never finished.
So then the next step must be another election then, which will hopefully go ahead without any violence of any sort.
Certainly, it would appear that the best scenario would be a clean election in Panama, because I don't think Mr. Endara has, he has the mandate of the polls, but that election was thwarted, so there has to be a new election to have a clear mandate. And certainly a position of a person that is appointed or sworn in a military base of an invading power does not hold a lot of international respect.
Do you think with a new election that Guillermo Endara would win, or who would you think would come out on top if, let's say, Manuel Noriega were captured or, you know, not in Panama at the time of the next election?
Well, this is a guesswork. I don't know who would run or who would be a coalition person or satisfied all sides, but certainly in order to have to really see the vote of the people in Panama, we will have to have a complete withdrawal of the American forces, including the American police, and which doesn't seem to be, at least the reports that we're hearing on the radio, is that they are going to be there for the long haul, and that is very disturbing indeed. So this whole claim of restoring democracy to Panama, again, that is not a very sound argument on the part of the United States to use that as an excuse for an invasion. The record of the United States promoting democracy in Latin America is dismal. We know that the United States has toppled a democratically elected government in Chile 16 years ago, and it took 16 painful years by the Chileans to try to restore their own democracy without their help of the United States. And recently we have seen how the United States has been putting money and logistics and arms to try to topple another democratically elected government in Nicaragua. So the claim that they want to restore democracy, it doesn't stand the scrutiny of the historical events of the record. In fact, they are supporting brutal military dictatorships like the government of El Salvador, which in fact it has a figurehead who's supposedly, quote, democratically elected, but in fact it is just a facade because the army has the real power.
Let me ask you with one final perspective, and that is the Canadian perspective. Brian Mulroney has come out in support of the U.S. Intervention in Nicaragua, or pardon me, in Panama, as has the British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Why is it that Canada is doing this? Is it simply because Canada is just an extension of the U.S. and will support the U.S. in whatever it does?
It certainly disturbs me, the position of Canada at this point, but let's remember it was not as simple as that. In other words, there's two sides in the Canadian support. One is that our government has regretted the use of force, and Prime Minister or Minister of External Affairs Clark has very clearly said in Parliament that Canada does not support invasions or intervention in internal affairs of other countries, period. And also has said something good, that is that the times are not any longer to call any country for as small as it may be the backyard of anybody else. But having said that, then we come on the second part, which is the one that disturbs me as a Canadian, which is, however, we're supporting this particular invasion because of the uniqueness of the case. So it is like if somebody says, well, I'm against rape, but this time we'll support this rape. Okay? So that is contradictory in terms. Now, I don't know why Canada is taking that position, but I don't think this represents an independent position. And certainly, Prime Minister Mulroney's at least declaration on TV was kind of emotional and using all kinds of adjectives against the foreign leader, and not very much based on international law. I think we Canadians have a clean record in international affairs, and our participation now in the Organization of American States is going to give us a chance again to play this kind of leadership role in which we are advocating non-intervention. We are advocating peaceful means of resolution of international conflict. And we can make no exceptions. And we are advocating the ruling of international law. And certainly the American action goes against the United Nations Charter and against the Organization of American States Charter, very clearly. Both of them have no exceptions in the respect for the integrity and sovereignty of the people.
Mr. Garcia, thank you for talking to me.
You're welcome.
Well, what happened, I think there was some sensitivity over whether or not people could go into polling stations. See, all the polling stations are basically, security is maintained by the military. So what they tend to do is 2 or 3 days before the election, as they're setting them up, they become militarized, and you get all these military soldiers with their machine guns who are in their battle fatigue who are basically guarding these structures. And that's sort of part of Chilean history. The military has played that role. So the concern was, well, when you're going in, you have to go by these people and whether or not they would let us in. And in some cases, they did stop people and say, you can't go in. And then it was just a question of arguing with them. And in my case, I was stopped once, but I simply argued that I'm a foreign representative and I'm here to see the election. And the guy basically backed off. I showed him my passport and I went in and I saw things. When we were in there, there was some concern about whether or not maybe people who were supporters of the Pinochet regime and Vichy, who was one of the presidential candidates, might say, hey, what are you guys doing here? But by and large, most people were really, really open and receptive and said, hey, take all the pictures in the world you want. So that there wasn't, most groups I don't think had problems.
Now, what did you see when you went in? Were you pleased with the way the election was going? Did you notice any cheating or fraud happening?
No, basically the election was very well handled. I mean, they had a way where first of all, the ballots had numbers on it, and people would register, they would give their ID card, and then they would get their ballots. And then, of course, the numbers were then, later on, after they had voted, you know, they put them into separate boxes. They were voting for the president and the senator, and a senator and a deputy. And then when the counting went, there were observers, so all of the political parties had scrutineers. So everything was done very openly, and there really, I don't think, was any chance, partly because there was pretty the official count, but there was also the opposition, the PPD, and the Christian Democrats had parallel computerized counting systems going so that all the results were really coming into three different places, the official and then the two opposition. And that meant that it would be very difficult for there to be any counting fraud. The question that you get into these kinds of elections is, even though everybody calls it a return to democracy, it really is only a quasi-democracy that they're creating there. And I think people have to be very clear about that. The Pinochet, realizing, of course, that after his loss last year, that the opposition was likely to win, had created a constitution with so many restrictions on it that it became almost impossible for them to win an absolute majority and do the kinds of things that we're accustomed to in any party that takes power.
Well, then maybe I could get your comments on what you think the future holds in Chile. We've got Mr. Aylwin, who is should receive the power of the government come March. But, of course, the big catch is General Pinochet still has control of the army, which will apparently last another 4 years. Is that another reason why you think it's a quasi-democracy and that true power will not be turned over to the new government?
It basically means that the president got an overwhelming support, and he's the president. But they didn't get a majority in the Senate. So Pinochet can appoint 9 in the Senate. So that means that the right in Pinochet's cronies are going to be able to control the Senate. And although the opposition won the House, the deputies, they don't have enough of a majority to change the Constitution. And that means that they're very hampered. The Constitution says that they can't touch the budget of the armed forces, that they can't appoint the leaders of the armed forces. It says they can't change the electoral laws to be more fair. So all of this has created a situation whereby Pinochet has ensured that the conservative faction of the society, with less than 30% of the vote, can probably take close to 50% of the representation in the society. So that creates a very difficult period. And, you know, one of the issues that's the big issue in all this, besides all of that stuff, is the question of, okay, are they going to improve the conditions of the poor? And what about human rights? Those are the two critical issues that Elwin is confronted with now. The big issue for the poor, of course, and all the poor barrios I went to, was that they said, look, there's been thousands of disappeared. There's been all kinds of human rights abuses. There are political prisoners. We want that stuff addressed. We want the military held accountable, and we want the political prisoners released. Well, there's no way that the new government under the present constitution can do that. So the expectations on the base is that they better do that, and we want them to do that. But Pinochet has tied their hands so much that it's going to enter a whole process of negotiations and maneuvering to try to deal with that issue. I mean, there's no doubt that their election, the election of Elwin and what happened there, was a defeat for Pinochet. I mean, there's no doubt that things are going to get better in the country. There's going to be more freedom. There's going to be more openings to speak, public speech, to organize, to... And in many ways, it's a great moment, and I think people right from the poorest barrios right up through the society and the opposition were extremely ecstatic because of that. You didn't get a million people out just celebrating so much for nothing. This is a victory, but it's a victory that's now entering into a whole other level of complexity in terms of maneuvering with the military and the conservative sectors of that society to try to move it towards a genuine democracy.
Well, as far as the elections themselves and Election Day, it was quite smooth. I think there was one incident where one policeman was killed, and it's not clear how it was related to the elections or not. The trouble spots came in the days following the elections, when there was some repression by the police against people who were gathering to celebrate and demonstrating. And it's hard to sort out the actual truth of what actually happened there, but there was the usual resort to tear gas and water cannons and beating up of various participants in the demonstrations. And that took place, though, the day after the election. The election day itself was perfectly calm.
Do you think that what happened afterwards with the celebrations might be symbolic of what could happen when Pinochet has to give over his power in March of 1990? Do you feel that there will be a smooth transition, or do you feel that there may be some problems?
Well, I'm inclined to think the transition will probably be very smooth. There's, I think, a fairly broad segment of Chilean society, the vast majority certainly, that is ready to see Pinochet go. And whereas many people would like to see him go even further, in other words, leave his position as commander-in-chief of the army and the armed forces, people are united, I think, the vast majority of people want him out of his current role as president. I think he's conceded that role is finished for him. He's also left things very well structured so that it's going to be very difficult for the next government to make any dramatic changes anyway. So there's really will be no benefit for him to try and cause trouble with the transition. He's designed a system so that his interests will be well protected.
Because you were down there, do you just have any? I know you probably weren't down there for that long, but how do you feel about the future for Chile, considering Elwin is in power now and it looks pretty good for the country?
Well, I think even all Chileans realize that the problems are only beginning. In a sense, most of them don't realistically expect major changes to occur into the economy. For example, when Elwin comes into power in March. They're all saying, some of them are saying, in fact, that the next 4 years will be even more difficult than the past, although that sometimes seems hard to imagine. I think you have to remember that Chile is a part of the whole world economic scene and that times are very tough for all developing countries right now. They'll be having to renegotiate loans with the World Bank within a year after the new government comes to power, and that can be very critical for a developing country. They'll have to make a lot of deals with the right-wing opposition in the country. The right-wing will be the opposition under the new government, and that's not going to be easy. The elections, whereas the presidential election was a clear victory for democratic forces, both the Senate and the Chamber of Deputies is much less clear, and the opposition didn't gain a sufficient number of votes to control either of those two legislative bodies. So there will be a lot of wheeling and dealing amongst the politicians, and I think continued pressure from the people in the form of demonstrations in the streets to press their demands.
Now, you said that you talked to a bunch of different groups when you were down there. How did you have any interesting people you talked to or any stories to tell about that?
Well, I remember one group of people we talked to after the election. We went out to one of the poorer parts on the outskirts of the city and met with a group of women who had been making arpilleras, those cloth pictures, really, of current events that are very popular in Chile. And we talked with women in this group who had been making these since the early days of the dictatorship, often as a primary means of support for them and their families. And they talked about the struggle over the past years and the repression they'd faced from time to time for just making their handicrafts. But when they started to talk about the elections and how they'd finally had free elections, one of them just broke down and cried. She was so moved. This was something that was so important to the people there that I think we were all of us on the delegation who were visiting these women, were really moved and touched by this, because elections here we just take totally for granted and, you know, tend to be fairly cynical about them. And when you've not been able to have a free and open political voice in 16 years, an election can make a big difference. I was quite touched by that woman.
Of course, I am very happy because the dictatorship is not there anymore, although he still have some power. But I trust the Chilean people, and I think slowly we will be reaching the real democracy, real democracy in Chile. I was happy in one hand, and in the other hand, I'm worried too, because there are issues which are very important for me, like human rights issues, the situation of the political prisoners, and also, the impunity law, which we consider that shouldn't be. I mean, all the responsibles for the crimes against people should be brought to justice, and also the answer for the hundreds of disappeared will be answered. So in a way I'm happy because I have the hope that those things will be, you know, answered in the near future.
Now Pinochet doesn't relinquish power until March. Do you think that it will be a difficult period when he does so, or whether or not the transition will be a smooth one?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be a very difficult time, and the transition is going to be a very, you know, delicate period of time. But as I say before, it depends on some things that we don't have yet, you know, the results. But I think Pinochet is gone. He lost a lot of, support, even between the armed forces. So I think he's gone.
Maybe now, you know, you left Chile in 1976. Can you tell us what it was like when you were living there, when Pinochet came to power, and how the country changed after Allende?
Yeah, well, it was a nightmare, and it was a very drastic change. I remember I was a student at the university at that time. I have my daughter was just a baby, and I always say that I was very happy to leave, you know, the Allende government, because as a student I had all the facilities, and as a young mother too. I will go to university with my daughter, where I had a daycare for babies, and they will take care of her, and I could go to my classes. And I could do other things, you know. I didn't have to put a lot of time into finding babysitters or things like that for my daughter. But that was cut very drastically. And that is my example. I know for in many sectors, education, health, participation, in many ways, we're all, you know, full. People all participated. But that changed from one day to another. And I was very surprised. I thought that would never happen in Chile. And to see, you know, people taking, you know, a human being, another human being to prison and to torture them was a shock. My father was he disappeared for a few months and he was badly tortured. And I saw him when he came out and I couldn't believe. But the thing is, you know, it's horrible. I mean, it's hard to explain. I lived there for 2 years. I moved from one city to another trying to set our life together again. You know, I was expelled from university. My husband lost his job. And we tried to put our lives together. But that was very, very hard because my husband was in a list because he did work for the government. So he couldn't find any other job because of that.
What do you see for the near future, in the near future for Chile?
Well, I think we are going to have a democracy finally, but I think there are difficult times to come. But I, as I say before, I have my hopes and I trust the Chilean people. And also, you know, we have learned so many lessons. I'm talking about, you know, different groups and different people. And I think if the thing we need in Chile is people to be united. And the Chilean people is very politicized. Everybody is involved in politics. So if we can try to make sense and to be more united, I think we will accomplish what the majority of the people want, which is peace, justice, and social justice. I think the country has a good economy. It's a rich country. You know, I think they can solve the economical problems. And the rest, you know, it has to be a proper handle of the Constitution to change the things in the Constitution and to make justice.